Merlin, man, welcome to the Other 51. Very excited to be talking to you today.
Hi, Brian. I'm very happy to be here.
First of all, since this is kind of a themed on Hamilton podcast, and I know from listening to your podcast that you're a fellow Hamilton nerd like me, first of all, how much are you digging the mixtape tracks that are coming out?
I'm really liking it. I'm liking it a lot. I really like Satisfied. I really like My Shot. I appreciate the Kelly Clarkson cover, but that's what's that? She does Quiet Uptown, right? Well, that song is the version in it's my favorite performance by that particular performer in the whole show, and it's such a killer song in the regular cast recording. So yeah, I know I like it all a lot. I'm glad to hear it all. It's nice to hear Busta Rhymes. It's always nice to hear him.
With the Kelly Clarkson version, I was thinking about when I was listening to it, and it's nothing to take away from her performance or the song, but for me at least, what makes the song and the show so powerful is that it's a very quiet and a restrained performance. Like that's where I think the power comes from, kind of like the restraint shown in the vocal. And the remix by Kelly Clarkson, it's very big vocal as she sings. She sings it beautifully, but for me anyway, the power of that song is just in the original is the kind of hushed tones it's sung in.
Yeah. Also, the tooth. Well, I mean, it comes at a very, very emotional point in the show, and I think two things. I agree with you. I mean, it's a great performance. It's just that part of what makes that song so powerful, as you say, is it's quiet, but also that it has at least three very important distinctive voices in it. You've got Alexander, you've got Eliza, and then you've got the chorus. I'm just reading a kind of classic play sense, and the ones who are kind of whispering, they're going through the unimaginable. That's the part that always gets me in that song, is them like observing this guy who threw this in. I mean, obviously both of them, but he's the main character. All through the show, he's had this big personality. And you can just, and this comes through in the Chernow book, and everything you read in the tome is that this was an event. The death of his son was an event that just took the wind out of him, and he never really recovered from it. They named their first child Philip. They named their last child Philip. I mean, we talk about that all the time in our house, how unusual that is. But no, I think it's really good. But that show has had a big impact. This is just about the time, I think, I want to say about a year ago when I stuck my toe into the Hamilton world. And I was really surprised. Like the first time I listened to it, I was like, this is good, really weird. And then like by the third or fourth time, by Christmas time, man, we were just listening to it constantly. And here's the last thing about this that's kind of funny is that we would kind of listen to it in what I want to describe almost as concentric circles, where we'd bump, 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 bump. We'd listen to the first song for a long time. We'd listen to the first three songs for a long time because My Shot is so great. The honest, real talk, it took me maybe 6 months to listen to all of Act One before I moved on to Act Two.
Really?
It's, oh yeah. I mean, I'd kind of had it on in the background, but I didn't really digest what a different thing Act Two was for months. And they're such really different shows in some ways.
Yeah, it's funny, but it's about just about a year ago that we discovered it too. My wife is a huge Broadway person, and she had gotten it for a road trip. She was driving from Rochester, where we live, down to the city, and finally bought it and was going to listen to it. She got a half hour down the road and said, "I'm in on Hamilton. You're going to be in. You're going to listen to this when I get home." And swear to you, she got home from her trip, hadn't seen her in 3 days. She sat me down in a chair with her phone and said, "You're not moving until you listen to the first six, seven songs of this." And I tried to get up to help her. I'm like, "No, you have to listen to it." And like, we got our kid, like you, we got our kid into it. And it is amazing to me how much that show just, it keeps giving. Like, listen, I can't,
It's tremendous. I feel like I mean, I don't have it in front of me right now, but just from memory, I feel like the way I've suggested, if you're not, and believe me, I understand like people who are overwhelmed by the hype on this. There's no way it could live up to the hype at this point. But if you really, really hate My Shot after listening to it four or five times, this may not be the show for you. But I feel like listening to it through Satisfied in particular, and listening to it through Satisfied a few times, you get a real flavor for the musical development, the character development. And also, to your point, it's been a jumping off point, at least two different ways for my family. Increasingly, I try not to speak for my daughter because she's nine and she can speak for herself. But I feel confident saying it's been an interesting jumping off point in two ways for her. The one smaller way is it's made her more interested in different musical things. I've always liked, I don't want to say I like all musicals. It's like poetry. I can't say I like it all. Mm. But, you know, I've really enjoyed a lot of the classic era of vocalists and Broadway. But, like, you know, it was kind of our way into Les Mis. Nice. There's a whole bunch of hip hop. I kind of stopped paying attention to hip hop right around the time it got really good again. Like, everything after Wu-Tang, I'm kind of zoned out on. Mm-hmm. But it got me into, like, going and discovering Shook Ones. It got me in going in and discovering Countdown by, is it Countdown by Beyoncé? The song that Satisfied is a little bit kind of heavily
influenced. I think so, yeah.
But, like, now we sit around listening to Les Mis, and she can sing tons of that. The other big part, the much bigger part, we talk about this story a lot, all of the elements of this story, so many interesting conversations. Like, Jefferson wrote most of the Declaration of Independence, but he had slaves, and all these are people of color playing these white guys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the way down to now, she's reading a really good I don't want to call it a kid's book, but it's a kid's book. It's a really good, if you're not going to sit down with the whole Chernow book, this book, I think it's called The Outsider. It's okay. A really good kid's biography of Hamilton that she's reading right now. I mean, she's 20 pages into it right now. But yeah, I said on another program recently, it reminds me, it's almost like our generation's Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
We're, you know, in a different way where there's so many kids that got into first reading and then got into fantasy, sci-fi, whatever, because of Harry Potter. And I feel like this is making a lot of kids interested in history in a way that even something like 1776 didn't, or, you know, mm-hmm. maybe Roots at its time. But yeah, I think it's been so positive and so joyful. And every bit of little culture that's come out of this, we own any book related to this. We've got the tome. Mm-hmm. We've got the music, like how the chords for the songs. We've watched the 60 Minutes thing numerous times. We've watched the Grammy performances many times. And the thing, well, I shouldn't say it, but there's a thing that cannot be said in the Hamilton community.
What's that?
Well, theoretically, sometimes there are things in the universe that exist on the back of certain trucks.
Oh, I am familiar. I am intimately familiar with the potential existence of such things.
Yeah, we don't. Yep. It's not discussed.
Mm-mm.
But that, if it existed, would be something that has aroused interest also.
Yes, and it's really cool.
Don't ask me for it.
Don't ask me either, anybody who's listening to this.
I feel so bad, but the thing is, let's just put it this way. Having listened to that a bunch, listened to the... What do they call it? The original cast recording. Don't call it a soundtrack.
Right.
That's kind of a bit on The Incomparable now. But even just getting to see Yorktown on the Grammys, or getting to see the performances on that PBS special.
Yes.
There's so much you cannot get about why this is not just great musically. It is such a cohesive show. Mm-hmm. The lighting is incredible. The performances are hilarious. Like Lafayette is really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And like King George is very, Jonathan Groff's performance is so funny. And mm-hmm. you kind of get that. You get that, like, he's coming out and, like, ha-ha, he's kind of doing a British Invasion song, like, in the midst of this Broadway show. Anyway, right. it's been a really nice thing. It's brightened a lot of the last year for us.
Absolutely. And it's very fun for us, as my daughter, she just turned 6, and she is all into being – she's a theater kid, total. She does theater in our hometown, and she's doing actually her 5th or 6th shows this week.
You're kidding me.
No, they
what
have
kind
a
– What kind of shows? What's she been in?
They do – let's see. She's – right now she's in Cinderella, and she's one of the Wicked Stepsisters. And she's done Jungle Book. What else has she done? Winnie the Pooh, Seussical, Willy Wonka. A lot of like the Broadway Disney type shows, and they adapt them for kids. So they're like an hour, 10 minutes long. And so she's all in, she loves doing it. It's what she wants to be when she grows up, and having something like Hamilton in our lives is like, you know, not just this big thing, you know, this big positive thing for all the reasons you said, but like we can watch the PBS thing and like that's behind the scenes. That's their dressing room. That's how they get ready for the show and kind of really tie that all together to her for her is really awesome. And plus, hearing a 5-year-old say, "And I'm the damn fool at Shoutem," art.
Oh God,
always art.
We were listening. We were just listening yesterday, and how can I say this? There's a wonderful triplet, I think, performed by Hercules Mulligan that uses a long curse that includes MF, mm-hmm. and she loves because it's the delivery of it is so good. She kept rewinding.
Yes, we don't. That's one part that my daughter doesn't know. She does not know what happens when you knock Hercules Mulligan down. She will soon enough, but she doesn't know that yet.
How do you manage that? Is there a clean version?
No, we usually just do a quick fast forward or skip ahead. So,
and some of the marquee songs have a curse in them, which is kind of a bummer. Oh, like she has a really good friend, her best friend since basically some friends of ours had a kid almost like within a week of us, week or 2 weeks, and that friend is very into musical. She's very into, through her mom, she's gotten very into Sound of Music and Fiddler on the Roof and all that, but she's banned from listening to Hamilton. But I'll tell you a secret. Don't listen to this, Mina. When she was over at the house, she got to listen to a little bit of Hamilton.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That's a sleepover. You sneak in, you get to play with the Amazon Echo, and you get to listen to a little Hamilton.
Oh yeah. So, real last Hamilton question, because we could talk forever on Hamilton and never get to anything else.
I got nowhere to be. I'm here for as long as you want.
Fantastic. So, what's your favorite song on the album right now?
Right now, this is a horrible thing. You know that German phrase "Ohrwurm." You know, you get an earworm. Mm-hmm. You get a song that you can't get out of your head, which can be very unpleasant. I don't say wake up with, but like as I am still asleep and waking up, every day I have some passage from a Hamilton song going through my head until I feel like a freaking crazy person. And like this morning, it's "I'm the oldest and the wittiest and the gossip and New York City is insidious." That it just keeps pounding against my skull over and over again. Maybe just if it won't be too self-indulgent, I could tell you what my path has been.
Okay.
Given that I did it in that concentric way, I love the first song.
Yes.
And if one were ever to see a performance of that first song, you get to appreciate how that is what it's almost like an overture in an old, like you think about if you ever see West Side Story and there's that at the beginning, it comes up and it's slowly fading in on those lines and like a red background, and it does an overture, which is like, we're going to play you little bits. It's not a musical overture in Hamilton, but it is a thematic overture. And like you say, they introduce all these characters and the brilliance of two people playing those, one person playing two characters and how they're thematically related, like Lafayette and Jefferson are related.
When I realized that, that was like 6 months in, like the "We fought with him, I died for him," and how it applied.
Yeah, I trusted him.
Oh
yeah.
My, and like how it fits both what those actors play.
Well, "We fought with him."
Yeah.
Is like, it's like, there's so many things like you could beat this to death to somebody who hasn't heard it and they're just going to shake their head. But like the use of the word "my shot" means three different things at least.
Right.
Which is so brilliant. It's your shot at success. It's your shot out of a pistol, and it's your shot out of a glass. Mm-hmm. And it's used in all of those different ways. And in this instance, we say "we fought with him." Well, we fought with him. Those two guys fought with him on the side of the Revolutionary War in Act One, mm-hmm. and they fought to take him down as different characters in Act Two. How did you come up with that? It's so brilliant.
It is. I've seen Lin-Manuel Miranda on Twitter say, "When y'all going to realize I'm playing chess and not checkers?" And that's like one of those moments that's like, yeah. So I interrupted you with your path. So, okay.
No, I mean, it's not just as simple as – it's partly as simple as the more I listened to a song, the more I liked it. But some of the songs that have really stuck with me now, I continue to love the bangers. Like, obviously, the hit song of this is "My Shot." Mm-hmm. There's a reason that – according to his claim, that took him a year to write. He says he wrote two songs in 2 years. He wrote the first song, he wrote the second song. "My Shot" is just brilliant. "Enter Me." I mean, the whole thing is so freaking good. But the ones that really nail me now, then the one that kind of became a sleeper that my whole family, like out of nowhere, suddenly got into at the same time was Skylar Sisters. Because it's such a great pop song. Mm-hmm. I really, really like "Satisfied." When I'm really feeling like rocking out, I really love "Guns and Ships" and "Yorktown." My daughter went through a phase for like 2 weeks. She would just listen to What's the one about Write Like You're Running Out of Time?
That is
Nonstop.
Yeah,
she would just listen to Nonstop, literally Nonstop. She's in the bathtub. It's on repeat. I'm just hearing it. Oh, dump, 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 dump. It's just over and over and over. And then, you know, I can only listen to the last third of it so often because it really affects me emotionally.
Right.
But I have to say, It's Quiet Uptown is very special. I think Burn is really, really quite good. But I don't know, my favorite, I guess probably My Shot, but Satisfied. I always forget the woman's name, but I find that actress utterly charismatic. Mm-hmm. Like did you watch the PBS special?
Yes.
Like where he's freestyling backstage, mm-hmm. and she's just so delightfully like juking along. She's just so effervescent. I don't know. I think Satisfied might be my favorite right now. It certainly pounds my skull at 6:15 every morning.
Mine right now is, and it took me a while to get to this, ironically, you know, kind of appropriately given the title, but Wait For It is the one that I've kind of been stuck on a lot lately. Just because that is such, you know, the whole show is big. Up to that point, it's big, it's loud, it's My Shot, it's bombastic, it's huge. And then you come in with that, with both Leslie Odom, who is brilliant and restrained, and then the chorus in that with like the preacher, it took a while for that one, because I think you're right, the big songs hit you at first, but then, you know, Wait For It, I'll listen to that 3 or 4 times on repeat in the car.
It's a couple things. It so well highlights one of the big themes of this, mm-hmm. which is that Hamilton is this brash character who from like the second song is saying, you know, I think this is actually misattributed to Hamilton, but Hamilton's most famous quote, which I think he didn't actually say, was, if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything.
Right.
And which is paraphrased in him talking to Burr. And that's the beginning of this huge opposition that leads to the duel eventually, is Hamilton has a strong feeling on everything. Mm-hmm. And Burr is politic. Burr wants to be able to move the goalposts whenever he needs to. For political reasons, it's not that he's a bad person, but he is a politician in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And in that song, he's like the Frank Grimes in that one. I mean, I don't know if you know The Simpsons,
oh,
but
very
he
well,
always
yeah.
reminds me of Frank Grimes. One time I posted a GIF of Frank Grimes, and it says, "Death does not discriminate between the sinners and the saints. It takes and it takes." Because that always reminds me of Frank Grimes. I'm Homer Simpson. I had to get back to my castle and eat my lobster. That's to me, that's him. Like, how does a bastard? It's like, oh, fucking Hamilton. Cut that out. But you know what? Also, two things, and you can see this in things that are legally publicly available, but there's two performances I think you can't. Well, David Diggs, to an extent, he's so gifted. But two, you don't appreciate the power, control, subtlety, and passion of either Burr or Washington,
right,
until you see it live. And there's a performance of what's his name? Chris Jackson and Lin-Manuel Miranda. A bunch of the cast does a performance at like a second time at the the White House. Mm-hmm. And they do the One Last Time song. Oh,
so
and
good.
He just buries the needle, and he's not doing like a Christina Aguilera, like I'm going to melt your head rendering of it, but it's sublime. And it's so controlled, but so powerful. You can't really fully appreciate either Odom or Jackson without seeing it live. Because what they bring to that, it's so big, so charismatic, and so moving.
I had a friend of mine who just saw it last weekend, I think, or within the past 2 weeks, she saw it. And she said she had sky-high expectations, and it exceeded them. And I think she saw it with Chris Jackson, one of his last performances. And that's one of the things she said was, you don't get how powerful Washington is on the soundtrack. So
yeah, apparently the audience, there's a, have you been on the Hamilton Incomparable show?
No, I have not.
They have been doing a podcast, Pod for Ham, where they go a song at a time through the musical.
Nice.
Yeah, it's really cool, and they get a really nice diverse mix of usually 4 people per song and just dive super deep on it. And a bunch of people have been on, have seen the show once, twice, more. And they all say that same thing. I mean, the audience is so, it's not a huge theater, mm-hmm. and the audience is so close. And like, there's the scene where they're talking about the ladies, and they're actually coming out to the edge of the stage and like flirting with people in the audience.
Oh,
and
neat.
Yeah, yeah. Oh man, and the way the stage is done with the turning, it's The woman who's the bullet, like the whole thing, yep. it's so bananas. I could talk about this all day.
I could easily do that too. One of the things on Wait For It, I love the story, and it's in the tome where Lin-Manuel came up with that couplet or that part of the song on the train going to a friend's birthday party. Like the death doesn't discriminate between the sinners, and the, like that whole part, it like came to him on the train. He like went to the party, dropped off the present, and went home to finish writing it. Like, ah.
That so guy good. Seems to have a really feverish mind. It seems he like does. he never stops operating.
He does. And so generous, too. Like, he just seems very generous with his...
It's so hard to know what somebody's really like, but, you know, and I'm going to be 50 in about a week, so I don't really sweat this stuff. But, like, I have to say, he really seems like a genuinely humane, game, generous person. I've heard him on podcasts where people can't keep themselves from starting to sing a song, and he sings along. I mean, can you even imagine how sick he is of those songs? It's like Mick Jagger doing Satisfaction. He's got to be so sick of that at this point. But like, he's totally game for it. He seems to still really appreciate like what his work has done for people. When you see those famous Lin-Manuel kind of memes of him looking like he's choking up.
Right.
I think he's genuinely moved by what he's done, not in a self-involved way, but like he's felt that with other people's music. And now he gets to see that reflected in the people who enjoy what he does. And it's a joy to watch.
I actually sent him a few months ago. I had sent him a little thank you note, just saying thank you for this great, something I do sometimes with people whose work I respect. I sent him a little thank you note, you know, just thank you, not asking for anything. Just thank you for making this thing that my family loves. And I sent him a little picture of my daughter on stage. And a few months later, he wrote me back. Handwritten little card, basically. Thank you for your support.
Do you know how busy that
guy is? Yes. And I'm like, this, you know, and it's just blew me away. Like, it didn't take him more than 5 minutes, but still, he took that time to do that for no reason other than to say thank you. Like, that just...
That's lovely.
It was. So we want to talk a little bit about actual writing, not Hamilton writing, though we can tie everything to Hamilton writing. I know you're mostly do podcasts for your living now, but you kind of came up on the internet as a writer and as a blogger. So I was wondering if you could kind of talk about your life as a writer and kind of like your career and how you got to where you are now and how writing played a part in that.
Yeah, sure. I think the thing that I kind of got well known for probably was 43 Folders, which is a website I did for several years about personal productivity and Mac stuff. And I was a blogger. That's like what I did. In the sense that I published my own site that I was the nearly primary sole, but the primary and nearly sole. I occasionally had guests, but I mean, the vast majority was me posting what, you know, usually 1 to 4 things a day could be links. But it was strange though, because it gave me a voice that I maybe didn't know I had. I sometimes got a little bit better at it, and so that's what I did. I wrote for the web, though.
Okay.
If you take my meaning, it's and now today, you know what? How many years later? 12 years later. It's such a different world for writing on the web. In particular, it's a tough time to be a writer, and I think that, like so many things in life, you start off thinking one thing is going to be your thing, and then you find this other thing and go, oh, that's a silly fun side thing I'll do. But my way of reaching an audience now is much more doing podcasts. And I think it's interesting to think about like how those are very similar and how they're so very different. And I'm always interested to think about like how the skills you pick up as somebody who writes a lot can be useful to other things, podcasts or otherwise, can become very useful, because there's a lot of the thinking process in writing applies to many, many other things. Mm-hmm. It's why I think it's so important to, I don't want to say teach writing, but to encourage writing, because writing encourages an exploration of your interests, of one's opinions. It forces you to say true things and that you can hopefully back up. But it also teaches you a lot about thinking and planning. It teaches you a lot about outlining, organizing, all the way down to capturing ideas, stuff that can be useful in so many other parts of your life that I don't think you have to be a constant professional writer, web or otherwise, to benefit from the things that writing can bring to you. And I still try to do that to this day.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so what are some of those skills that you developed when you were writing for your job and more of a full-time writer that you're finding useful now in your podcast life?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one thing is the this already feels like a generation away, the idea of having a website that is mainly your job mm-hmm. that you write for. I mean, that's a surpassingly small number of people that ever did that. And now today, I think it's probably getting smaller and smaller for a variety of reasons that may not be interesting, but might be. But there's a constant pressure because whether or not one wants to be driven by page views, you also realize that you're really only as good as the last thing you posted. Mm-hmm. And I'll speak for myself. I felt a lot of pressure that I put on myself, somewhat that I got from others, but I felt a lot of pressure to publish often. So one of the things was it was kind of stressful, honestly, even though I really loved doing it, is that I never really felt like I was not at work.
Okay.
So, you know, because when you're doing your own thing, you're kind of never really off work, which mm-hmm. which has its downsides. But it got me really thinking about things like, you know, I don't have that many good ideas and I can't afford to lose too many of them. So it got me into a habit of writing things down a lot more. Actually, something that was a topic on 43 Folders Often, Ubiquitous Capture, this idea of like having a place to capture things that you still haven't made a decision about, I think is valuable for everybody. I'm reluctant to call this writing, but there's still a large writing component to what I do, whether that's thinking about whether that's, you know, getting in a Google Doc with John Siracusa planning out topics, whether that is massaging ad copy, whether that's writing show notes. You would not even believe how long it takes me to write 1,000 words of show notes for one of my shows.
Really?
It's silly. And they're not even good. It's just that I want them to be a certain way. And so I do all my old tricks. I try not to repeat verbs. I try to write in a certain tone. And actually, one of the peculiar joys of doing shows can be doing the show notes. It's a really weird thing, but like how you decide to curate the links. Do you rename them? Do you clean up the way that the links are displayed? Do you, you know, there's all these little things, and there's 1,000 little micro writings that you have to do. So it still affects me there, but it affects me in lots of other parts of my life too. That Ubiquitous Capture idea never went away. It mm-hmm. seems crazy to me to ever have to, like, you know, have an idea twice. So that's, even though my ideas don't turn into writing so much, the public writing anymore, I think that's been really valuable to me. And it's something I would counsel people to really consider.
And I know that, you know, especially on Back to Work, you guys talk about writing a lot, even though you guys aren't necessarily talking about maybe writing professionally. The topic seems to come up a lot, whether it's journaling, using your notebook, or just in general, the idea of, you know, maybe helping people get to a place where they can write a lot. I was thinking about this because I actually got from the library today Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, a book mm-hmm. that you've talked about a lot and I'm finally reading for the first time.
Oh, well, that's terrific. I hope you'll enjoy it.
And so far, it's wonderful. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking about Bird by Bird by Annie Lamott. And it feels weird but to say this, but it feels like a lot of the best books on writing are almost self-help books in the best possible way. You know, they're not so much about writing. There's just so much, you know, maybe thinking or clarity or discipline. There's just something where I feel like a good book on writing is a lot more about a lot more than just writing. It can almost be a self-help book.
Oh, I think there's no question about it. I think that's actually a really good way to put it. To pivot a little bit to my former obsession with the idea of email, like I've always said about email, is email, it's not email that's hard. It's human relationships that are hard mm-hmm. and expectations from others and yourself. If email were just a bunch of letters that appeared on your screen, you just throw it all away or you just wouldn't even check it. But there could always be something in your inbox that has an impact on the world and how you see yourself. And not to be overdramatic about it, but I think it's a similar thing with writing. Writing itself doesn't need to be difficult. If you need to write a note to your neighbor or mm-hmm. you need to, you know, any of that kind of stuff, that doesn't have to be difficult. What's difficult, apart from getting good at it and doing it regularly, is giving yourself permission to reveal parts of yourself or to explore things. You know, good writing should surprise you. When you're writing something that ends up being good, you will frequently really surprise yourself. And that could be something like, wow, this is something I didn't know I felt this strongly about until I had to make sentences. I mean, I'm not a neuroscientist, but like my gut tells me that there's a kind of thinking that we do when we're just kind of moseying around. This sort of gets to Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which is a really interesting book. But you know, you there's a certain kind of like just walking around, do-do-do-do-do kind of way of thinking about writing. But then once you actually put your hands on it, once you actually sit down and start trying to produce sentences that become paragraphs, that become bigger units, and you have to develop a thought and make, you know, get to your callback and turn it into an actual story, that really forces a diff. I feel that that forces a different mode of thinking that is not simply difficult, but it can be very painful for people.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us are very riddled with self-doubt about even undertaking that. That feels difficult and maybe pointless. It feels like an exercise in doing something you're not even meant to be any good at. And what those books like The Two-Year Discovery, those are two of the best, Bird by Bird and Writing Down the Bones, as you say, they are in a sense self-help books, because it's a way of saying, you know, part of it is a way of saying, like, what you think of as writing, you mostly come at through reading.
Mm-hmm.
And what you, the equipment and the attitude and the ethic that you need to actually produce writing is going to seem very weird once you actually try to do it. And I think you need a book like that. You need someone to tell you, to give you a way in to getting started with that, to say, look, what you're feeling is not strange. Everybody feels this way.
Right.
And that's, people like having written, but not that many people actually enjoy writing. That's right. Kind of a myth.
Right. It's the old Red Smith, who was a sports writer for the longest time in New York City, very famous one, said, writing's easy. You just sit down at the typewriter every day and open up a vein and drip a few blood drops of blood out on the paper and you're done.
Yeah. There's a quote I want to eventually, I want to get this quote exactly right, because the way this was said is so smart. There's a podcast I like a lot with Max Temkin and Patrick Rothfuss. Just kind of two guys talking podcast called Unintended Consequences. But Patrick Rothfuss is a novelist. He wrote Name of the Wind, and he's been a teacher, and he thinks a lot about these processes in a very practical way.
Mm-hmm.
But he said something a few episodes back that was along these lines, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said something along the lines of, like, one way he started getting better in life was to stop comparing his backstage to other people's onstage.
Oh, that's good.
And I almost always tell this in a way that doesn't really get at why that's so powerful. But I think that's what a lot of us do.
Mm-hmm.
We take all of our random, stupid, self-defeating ruminations on life and then hold that up against somebody's 17-minute TED Talk and go, like, wow, that they really arrived. It's like, well, yeah, but that's, you're seeing the finished product there. You're not really seeing, and setting aside the fact they're probably not going to tell you about their own self-doubt unless that's part of the TED Talk, that you, those books, I think, help you to understand that most of the work is going to be about backstage.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you don't hold yourself up against these other people. You know, do your thing and be okay with how weird and chaotic that can be. And if you do it often enough, you will find a way through.
Right. And I know that back when Back to Work kind of started, you were in the middle of trying to write a book. Do you mind if I ask you about that book? I know it kind of fell apart.
Yeah,
back then,
it's kind of a sore spot. My ambitions on that were, I think a first book is difficult for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the biggest problem for me, on a practical level, even getting out of like the demons in my head, I think I realized that with 43 folders, I found it invigorating to write in mostly freestanding blocks that were rarely under 1,000 words and pretty rarely over 5,000 words. And the challenge with a book is, like, you have to have this really big idea that goes across all of those different things. And, you know, my self-doubt about that was just overwhelming. And I found it very difficult to pivot to that bigger thing, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, that was really difficult. The other thing is, like, you know, just today it is so difficult and seemingly frustrating to me. I just don't want to write for the web right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sound like an old man, but, like, setting aside the fact that it's become kind of financially challenging to write for the web, like, what people want from the web has really evolved. And the way that people consume stuff on the web has really evolved. And, you know, whereas 10 years ago, I could reel off, you know, 25 really, really well-written blogs that updated at least once a week. I don't have as many of those today. I follow my friends' sites, but I think it's a really challenging time for anybody who writes anything. You can't really set aside the financial part, because if you're going to do it for money, you need to make money.
Right.
But the other really challenging part of it is that people are consuming stuff so differently now. And I read a lot, but I read lots of little chunks of stuff a lot. I don't even have the attention span that I had 10 years ago. It's bananas.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I was just talking to one of my classes about Google Analytics and metrics this week, and deciphering what it all means. And I tried to tell them, and this is, you know, the back to work listener and me telling them lessons I've been hearing you and Dan talk about for 8 years or whatever, is, you know, focus on making good stuff before you worry about any kind of metric number. Because, you know, I've tried it on my own site. You try to chase numbers, you try to chase a metric, you know, just try to make a little extra money, and it drives you mad, and it's a crapshoot, and I didn't find myself doing really good work. I found myself kind of, you know, to use your word from your great essay, cranking, just kind of putting stuff out there to try to, you know, capture something or try to get some posts or links or whatever. And it wasn't satisfying to me. And so I'd rather.
It's such a multivariate problem, because how do I put this? I think about this talk that John Gruber and I did at South by Southwest. It seems like a million years ago. It was probably maybe 2009.
I think it was 2009. Yeah.
But I like that talk a lot. It already seems so antiquated. I mean, basically, blogging was already almost dead, and we just kind of didn't know it in some ways. But we were just talking about how to. It was sort of a backlash against the then somewhat new phenomenon of listicles, which has always driven me bananas. The listicles and the turns outs and the, like, this will surprise you, and you have to be a 90s kid to understand that. And it's kind of a way of saying, you know, well, here's, at least we've had some measure of success with this by trying to reach this kind of audience. But I think that's still useful as a pep talk, but I'm not sure how practical it is today.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Gruber's Gruber. Like, how many Grubers are there out there? And by that, I just mean, like, how many people who are the single writer for a property, how many people like that do you follow about how many topics?
Right.
And there's really not that many. And that's changes in demand. In that case, it's also changes in, like, the way that people don't self-identify as Apple people as much as they used to. But, you know, there's a certain kind of I'm trying to avoid saying identity politics, but there's some combination of identity politics and social media that has led us to think a lot about what things we choose to share, because they will telegraph something about who we want to be seen as.
That's a good point, yeah.
And that could be something like that fraught phrase, virtue signaling. This could be your safety pin that you're wearing. It could, whatever it is, there's all these various ways that we are, as consumers of social media and news, the things that we choose to share and how we choose to share it become like little merit badges on our sash.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of things that I've had great success. Some of the most popular things I've ever written were very kind of passionate, like, I'm in a weird place right now things that people were able to share because they could say, yeah, I've been in that weird place too. Mm-hmm. 10 tips on how to use Quicksilver would be a tough sell today. and I mean, you know, it's sometimes quite surprising to find out, like, what people are making money-wise and what people are accomplishing career-wise on what feel like these giant sites.
Right.
So that's all really changed. I don't know what the future will hold, but podcasting has been such a satisfying move for me, because I've always been interested I've been interested in trying to reach the people I'd like to reach with the kind of thing that I would want to listen to or read in that case. And I have to say, with the whatever mainly four podcasts that I do, setting aside guest things, I'm so happy that I get to do it with all of those people, and I'm so happy that it reaches the people that it does. And these are not huge shows. This is not like Joe Rogan level success, but like, it does reach the people that I want to reach in these different little pie slices. And so I still feel like I'm getting a chance to connect with people. And then sometimes we talk on Twitter and stuff like that. And I don't know, it turned out to be much more satisfying than I could have expected.
What's the best thing you've read lately?
The best thing that I have read lately. I do not read nearly as much as I used to. We made a trip to the bookstore a couple days ago to pick up my daughter is a very she's become a very costly thing in my life with her reading. She reads a lot, and I try to supplement that mostly with library stuff, but sometimes we'll just go, okay, we'll just get all the Captain Underpants books because that's a thing. And I pick up the Lapham Quarterly book on Hamilton.
Okay.
Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
You might see it on newsstands. It's okay. You know, the guy used to be at Harper's does a thing called Lapham's Quarterly, and it's a whole kind of perfect bound, bigger than a magazine, smaller than a book, of stuff related to Hamilton. Kind of like, well, this has been a sensation. Now let's talk about like what really happened.
Okay.
A whole bunch of different people contributing. I like that a lot. There's a lot of books I keep struggling to finish. Again, that Daniel Kahneman book, Thinking Fast and Slow. I don't know what year I'm ever going to finally finish reading that book, but that's really, really good. In the wake of the election, you know, amidst all the fear and the rending of garments, there's been a lot of really interesting pieces I've been reading about security that I think are thought-provoking. What about you? What's the best thing you've read recently?
Let's see. Well, my daughter and I we're doing the Harry Potter series, so we're on Goblet of Fire right now. It gets dark. We just last night got to the point where they both grabbed the Goblet of Fire and start getting the Porky. And she was all excited because Harry, they're going to tie. She was very distraught that Cedric was going to win. And then they decide to go together, and she gets excited, does the countdown, and then the chapter ends with them being sucked into the Porky. And yeah, so shit's getting real, and we have to read the next chapter. My rule is we can't read it before bed because the next chapter is the thing the that grave, happens.
It's the graveyard, yeah.
Right? And it's the first part of the graveyard. So it's the thing. It's the Cedric getting killed. No spoilers, but if you're listening to this, you know this by now. Cedric gets killed, and Voldemort and Wormtail does all the things he has to do to bring Voldemort back. And I think she's going to be okay, but that is not a bedtime story. That will make for a very, very long night. And I think that's the best book. I mean, I did a reread of the series. I have a long commute, so I did the audiobooks for my first year.
Did you do the Jim Dale one?
Yes, so good.
Oh, that guy's the best.
Yeah, and now I can't do Hermione.
Just look at the state of his robe. He dresses like our old house elf.
My daughter yells at me when I try to say Harry when it's Hermione. I can't not do it. So I think
every time I do an ad spot for Harry's razors, I want to say Harry.
So that's the best thing ever. I just finished a book on I forget the name of it, but it's about the building of Penn Station. And the railroad tunnels underneath the river that brought the railroad into New York City. And it took me a long time to read. It was interesting. I don't know if it was really, I don't know, there was something about it that made it a very slow read. But I'm fascinated by the train stations and the transportation in New York City. So that was a cool book to read.
Wow, did you ever read The Power Broker?
No, I don't. I that's one of the massive books that's on my list that I need like a full summer to read, I think.
Yeah. Derek Hughes likes to check in with me once in a while and see if I made it past the 28th page. It's a very long, it's a very, very long book.
I have that, and that's why, like every summer I have Infinite Jest. This is the summer I'm going to read Infinite Jest, and
I'm finally going to watch the second half. I'm finally going to watch Millennium Actress, too. I'm so embarrassed to say this. When this past Tuesday night happened the way that it happened, Tuesday before last, as we record this, our family was in a state and we had an emergency. We decided to schedule an emergency liberal mini vacation. So we went away for a couple nights over this past weekend. And, one of the things I read, this is light, certainly not his best thing, but, this Kurt Vonnegut book, A Man Without a Country.
Huh. I don't remember
which
that
is,
one,
you know, though. It's a little bit of not a cash grab exactly, but I think it was published posthumously, but it's just a bunch of little essays. But he's always been one of my favorite authors. I still have such a strong feeling about when I first started reading Kurt Vonnegut when I was 15 or 16. And I got to meet him at one point, which was one of the best days of my life. And I still have such a feeling for him. And when I had to pick something to sit by the pool and read, that's what I grabbed and brought with me. We brought the Hamilton. Mm-hmm. We brought Kurt Vonnegut. And I still – sorry, Patrick, I still haven't read Name of the Wind. but – I'm going to do it someday. I bought the, sometimes when I feel bad about a book, I buy a different copy of it. So like I have it on Audible now. I have owned three copies of Infinite Jest and I haven't read any of them.
I'm on my second and eventually I will do it. I will, but I don't know when that will be. So
but if you're looking for a little something to, I don't know. It's just, this is Kurt Vonnegut mostly writing about, you know, his themes, his humanistic themes during the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, his style and the lightness of his prose, but the heaviness of his personality. I mean, he's a pretty almost not morose guy, but like I think he's definitely had depression in the past, but you know, he's just such a classic American Mark Twain kind of character where he thinks a lot about the country. And so, yeah, Man Without a Country, that's a good light read.
Yeah, and I've been coming back to it, sitting on my desk right next to me, the My Life is a Weapon, the first Hawkeye from the Fraction Aha run.
That's
and
so good.
So good. That, one of the many things Back to Work brought into my life was reading, getting back into comics, and the Hawkeye was, that whole run was just special to me. It was
special is the right word for it. Yeah, I totally agree.
So Merlin, man, thank you for joining me. This has been outstanding.
Oh, thank you, Brian. You know, have me back anytime. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
And don't throw away your shot.